The Journey Thus Far, written and remembered by James Roos Evans.
I've called this program The Journey Thus Far because at the age of 88, looking back over my life, I'm very aware of how certain writers have influenced me and shaped me. And of course, the journey still continues. I find almost every day some new book I'm reading, I am typing out a passage of words that is an insight or an illumination. One of the problems today, however, is that we live in a world where we are inundated with words as information. We're barraged by them. And yet, words are more than information. They are sounds. There's the music of words and the symbolism of words. People use words like love and peace without any awareness of what these words mean. And I recall Robert Frost saying once how you can know a poem by heart and then suddenly you hear someone speak it with a particular tone on a particular word and whole new meanings are opened up. I remember his saying, the living part of a poem is in its intonation. And the very first poem that I remember was one that my mother used to sing to me at night. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. Up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. It was the first poem I encountered. And living in the country, those words made me also aware of the beauty and splendour of the night sky, which has remained with me always. And I remember a few years back, living in County Cork by the sea, one night after midnight, lying on my back, watching the shower of Perseus, which happens every August, when shooting stars plunge and fall like a shower of silver petals. Sadly today, with light pollution, people who live in cities are never aware of the majesty of the night sky. But for a child learning to read for the first time, perhaps the most apt word is sesame. It's a magic word. It opens up new worlds. And the first book one reads leads on to the second. And as we go down the rabbit hole through the looking glass or the magic wardrobe, we're constantly discovering world after world, the world of the imagination and of reality. There's a moment in Frances Hodgson Burnett's classic, The Secret Garden, when Mary asks her guardian if she might have a piece of earth. A piece of earth, he repeats, and she replies, to plant things in, to make them grow. And he answers, child, when you see a piece of earth, take it and make it come alive. Which is exactly what Mary and Colin and Dickon do. And then, having weeded and replanted the secret garden, what do? They sit cross-legged in it and meditate. It's totally unexpected, but it reminds me of some words by the great Sufi mystic and poet Rumi. It's when we nurture the seeds of meditation in our own inner garden that we begin to come alive at a deeper level than that of mere happiness. Happiness is elusive. It comes and goes. What grows and becomes evergreen in our innermost garden is contentment. My friend Mirabel Osler, in her book, In the Eye of the Garden, writes, gardeners have to believe that the dead will reincarnate. It's not only the plants that bloom with such perverse bravado in the midst of winter that I love, but also the dead black sticks of winter. Pick one. And know with absolute certainty at that moment you are holding summer. It's partly because I have loved creating gardens, two in Wales and one in Ireland by the sea, that I love this anonymous Elizabethan poem. My master hath a garden fulfilled with divers flowers, where thou mayst gather posies gay all times and hours. Here nought is heard but paradise bird, harp, dulcimer and lute, with cymbal and timbrel and the gentle sounding flute. O Jesus, Lord, my heel and wheel, my bliss complete, make thou my heart thy garden plot, true, fair, and neat, that I may hear this music clear, harp, dulcimer, and lute, with cymbal and timbrel, and the gentle sounding flute, that I may hear this music clear. Just to return for a moment to a child's love of words. I remember three small boys sitting on a wall in our garden in London, whispering back and forth, just one word, and they were giggling. The word was perpendicular, but clearly what they were enjoying, what was for them a supposedly naughty word, dick. And that reminded me of my very great friend Ethel Spencer Pickering, about whom I've written in my memoirs, who was 50 years older than I, but those years made no difference to the great love between us. And one night, we were walking arm in arm across a field with clouds scudding past a full moon, when suddenly Pick, as she was known, declaimed the following verse. O moon, when I behold thy wondrous face careering through the boundaries of space, how oft the thought comes to my mind, when shall I see thy glorious behind? Born as she was in the 1880s, the word behind must have had a similar forbidden appeal to a child as the word dick did for those three small boys. In our house, apart from several volumes on the First World War and a copy of Dante's Inferno with its fearsome illustrations by Gustave Doré, there was one book that I devoured with glee, Harry Graham's Ruthless Rhymes for Heartless Children. And here are two of my favourites. Father heard the children scream, so he threw them in the stream, saying as he drowned the third, children should be seen, not heard. And the other more sinister one. In the well which Uncle built her, Aunt Eliza fell. We must buy a filter. Children also often have a way with words that cuts right to the essence of a story. Once, when I was in Ireland leading a weekend retreat for some 300 Catholics, Monsignor Tom Feely, who was then the director of the Christian Meditation Movement in Ireland, gave me the following account of Jairus's daughter from the Gospels, as recounted by a little girl in a primary school. "'Twas like this. Jesus Christ was going along the road, and the sun was blazing, and he was all sweating, and the crowds of people were all there after him, and they were shouting and roaring and belting each other. Then all of a sudden, up comes a big man, important, one of them, and he drops down on his knee, and he looks up at Jesus Christ. He says to him, Jesus Christ, would you ever help me? My daughter's back home, and she's dead or near it. Would you ever make her better? Says he, I will, of course. Come on back. Show me where you live. Then back he goes, the two of them, till they come to the big man's house, and in they go. And you know what? It was a house with stairs. All the way up. And didn't Jesus Christ go up them stairs? And he was nearly deaf, because there was loads of women, and they were bawling and shouting, and he never heard anything like them. And he stops there on the stairs, and his hands shutting off the noise from his ears, and he says, will you shut up and get out, the lot of you? And didn't they do so? And there was just Jesus Christ with the daddy and the mummy and the corpse. And he says to the corpse, get up out there. And she opened her eyes and looked at him, and she's able to get straight up. She wasn't sick any more. And Jesus Christ, he looks at her too, and he sees she's well. And he says to the mammy, give her a cut of bread. I am forever indebted to my mother for many things, but who very early on taught me certain sentences which I had to say aloud to improve my diction, such as a big bow-wow prowling round about the house, and also round the rugged rock, the ragged rascal ram. And all of this came in handy when, at the age of 18, I was conscripted into the army and became a sergeant in the Royal Army Education Corps. I was stationed at Buchanan Castle outside Glasgow and put in charge of teaching trainee sergeants how to speak. And one day, I decided to take my men up onto the battlements and got them singing out to Ben Lomond the Welsh girl's name, Anharad, in long, drawn-out syllables. Anharad, over and over again. Suddenly, I was aware of the sergeant major down below, trying to drill a platoon of men. He called them to a halt and then bellowed up to me. He had very powerful projection. "Sergeant, for Christ's sake, take those bleeding men somewhere else." I looked around the battlements and I saw all these chimneys. So I invited each soldier to go to a chimney and resonate down it the words, "A big bow-wow prowling round about the house." After a while, a trapdoor lifted and a weary-looking officer appeared to say to me, "Sergeant, do you mind taking your men somewhere else? I'm trying to teach a lesson down below and all this canine rubbish is coming down the chimney." I was always getting into trouble. Of course, Lewis Carroll loved creating new words, such as galumphing and my beamish boy, and the slimy toes to gyre and gamble in the wabe. I was going to read The Mad Hatter's Teapot from Alice, until I came across a real-life version of such a party. It's the description of a lunch at Clarence House, written by, but not published until after the Queen Mother's death, by the last of her young equerries. And you'll soon see why it relates to the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Luncheon at Clarence House, as told by Major Colin Burgess. The summer of 1995 had been glorious, constant sunshine, and this day no different. The Queen Mother was enjoying lunch in the garden of Clarence House with her home team. Her treasurer, Sir Ralph Anstruther, her private secretary, Sir Alastair Aird, her senior lady-in-waiting, Dame Frances Campbell Preston, and me. We'd finished the main part of the meal. The wine, a full-bodied claret, which wasn't really conducive to a hot summer's day, had been passed round and a few bottles drunk, and conversation dipped in and out of subjects as diverse as World War II and the latest episodes of EastEnders. About 5 minutes after we finished our main course, though, I began to notice the chatter was slowing down. And then I saw Sir Ralph nodding off, and I just thought, oh, well, never mind, he'd done this before, and age was catching up with him. But no sooner had he started snoring than the Queen Mother closed her eyes, and she was asleep. This was a first for me. I'd never seen the Queen Mother fall asleep during a meal. I turned to Sir Alastair to ask her advice, because I really didn't know what to do. I mean, what is the correct procedure for waking up a member of royalty who's nodded off during a meal? Alastair was unable to answer me because he too had fallen asleep. And the next thing I heard was a gentle thud on the dining table as Dame Frances' head hit it, and she'd gone as well. The four of them sat there, absolutely out of it. I sat there for 5 minutes, which became 10. All in all, I sat there for a full 35 minutes, not knowing what the hell to do. Eventually, it got to the point where I felt something had got to happen, so I thought, damn it, and I rang the bell, which summoned the servants, in a desperate attempt to rouse them. Now, this was a major breach of protocol. Nobody can ring the bell unless invited to by the Queen Mother. And blimey, as soon as it rang, they all sat up and just carried on from where they left off, with Ralph exclaiming, and of course the Allies simply gave in once the Germans had gone, and off they all went, chattering away as though the whole of the previous 35 minutes had never happened. I recall how growing up and adolescence was, as for many, a painful process of not knowing quite who one was or where one was going. And the American poet Mary Oliver catches this superbly in her poem called The Journey. She's one of the great living poets of America. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with his stiff fingers of the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough. and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. In one of his letters, John Keats wrote, "The third chamber of life shall be a lucky and gentle one, full of the bread of friendship and the wine of love." And throughout my life, I have been blessed by remarkable friends, one of whom early on was the writer Eleanor Fargem, who lived in Hampstead and did more than anyone to encourage my writing. She was also the first patron of the Hampstead Theatre Club, and it was in her garden room that the project was launched. People of all ages would find their way to her for advice and sympathy, just as every battered, flea-bitten cat in the neighbourhood would find its way to her kitchen window to be fed. And this poem that she wrote, Mrs. Malone, is not only a philosophy of life, but it conveys the very essence of Eleanor herself. Mrs. Malone lived hard by a wood, all on her lonesome, as nobody should, with her crust on a plate and her pot on the coal, and none but herself to converse with, poor soul. In a shawl and a hood she got sticks out of door, out of a bit of old sagging she slept on the floor, and nobody asked how she fared, or knew how she managed, for nobody cared. Why make a pother about an old crone? What for should they bother with Mrs. Malone? One Monday in winter, with snow on the ground so thick that a footstep fell without sound, she heard a faint frostbitten peck on the pane, and went to the window to listen again. There sat a cock sparrow, bedraggled and weak, with half-open eyelid and ice on his beak. She threw up the sash, and she took the bird in, and mumbled and fumbled it under her chin. "You're all of a smother, you're fair overblown. I've room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Tuesday, while eating her dry morning slice, with the sparrow a-picking, in company nice, she heard on her doorpost a curious scratch, and there was a cat with its claw on the latch. It was hungry and thirsty, and thin as a lath, it mewed and it mowed on the slithery path. She threw the door open and warmed up some pap, and huddled and cuddled it in her old lap. "There, there, little brother, your poor skin and bone, there's room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Wednesday, while all of them crouched on the mat, with a crumb for the sparrow, a sip for the cat, there was wailing and whining outside of the wood. And there sat a vixen with six of her brood. She was haggard and ragged and worn to a shred, and her half-dozen babies were only half-fed. But Mrs. Malone, crying, "My, ain't they sweet," happed them and lapped them and gave them to eat. "You're warm yourself, mother, you're cold as a stone. There's room for another," said Mrs. Malone. Come Thursday, a donkey stepped in off the road with sores on his withers from bearing a load. Come Friday, when icicles pierced the white air, down from the mountainside lumbered a bear. For each she had something, if little, to give. Lord knows, the poor critters must all of them live. She gave them her sacking, her hood and her shawl, her loaf and her teapot. She gave them her all. What with one thing and t'other, my family's grown, and there's room for another, said Mrs. Malone. Come Saturday evening, when time was to sup, Mrs. Malone had forgot to sit up. The cat said meow, and the sparrow said beep. The vixen, she's sleeping. The bear let her sleep. On the back of the donkey, they bore her away through trees and up mountains, beyond night and day, till come Sunday morning they brought her in state through the last cloud bank as far as the gate. "Who is it?" asked Peter, "you have with you there?" And donkey and sparrow, cat, vixen and bear exclaimed, "Do tell us, up here she's unknown. It's our mother, God bless us. It's Mrs. Malone, whose havings were few and whose holding was small, and whose heart was so big it had room for us all. Then Mrs. Malone of a sudden awoke. She rubbed her two eyeballs and anxiously spoke. Where am I, to goodness, and what do I see? My dears, let's turn back. This ain't no place for me. But Peter said, Mother, go into the throne. There's room for another. One Mrs. Malone. It was through Eleanor that I learned about the great dancer Nijinsky, but above all about the poet Edward Thomas. And it was through Eleanor also that when I first went to America, I was given an introduction to Robert Frost, whom I was to meet on several occasions. And it was Frost who, just before the First World War, was living in England with his wife and family, who befriended Thomas and encouraged him to break away from prose and start writing poetry. And it was then, in the very few years remaining to him before he was killed at the front, that the poems poured forth. His poetry broke with the self-conscious poetic style of the Georgians, and like Frost's, becoming almost conversational in style, and yet compact and beautifully structured. And what Frost said, when you listen to a speaker, you hear words, but you also hear tones. And it's about writing with your ear to the voice. And in this famous poem of Edward Thomas's, it's called Adlestrop, which is about a small railway halt, which I used to pass regularly when I was travelling up to Oxford from Gloucester. Yes, I remember Adlestrop, the name, because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwontedly. It was late June. The steam hissed. Someone cleared his throat. No one left, and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adlestrop, only the name, and willows, willow herb and grass and meadows sweet, and haycocks dry, no whit less still and lonely fair than the high cloudlets in the sky. And for that minute, a blackbird sang close by, and round him, mistier, farther and farther, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. Returning to Keats' letter, it's after he speaks about the bread of friendship. He goes on to speak about the wine of love. And to me, the greatest of all arts is that of love. And so it's not surprising that Rilke once, writing to a young poet, said, "To love is good, love being difficult. For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation." And for this reason, young people, who are beginners in everything, cannot yet know love. They have to learn it with their whole being, with all their forces. Some of the greatest love poetry was written in the 16th and 17th centuries, when haunted by the brevity of life. And perhaps the most haunting of all love poems is a short verse from an anonymous Elizabethan poem, which goes, "O western wind, when wilt thou blow the small rain down on me? Christ, that my love were in my arms, and I in my bed again." Here are two more love poems. The first by Robert Burns, which is like a fanfare of bagpipes heard on a frosty night. "O my loves, like the red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. O my loves, like the melody that's sweetly played in tune. As fair art thou, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I. And I will love thee still, my dear, till a' the seas gang dry. Till a' the seas gang dry, my dear, and the rocks melt with the sun. And I will love thee still, my dear, while the sands of time shall run. and fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well a while. And I will come again, my love, though it were 10,000 mile. I mean, how could any girl resist him? And then a poem that moves me very much by one of the outstanding figures of the Elizabethan period, soldier, scholar, poet, who died at the age of 28, Sir Philip Sidney, which describes the love between two men. My true love hath my heart, and I have his, by just exchange, one for the other given. I hold his dear, and mine he cannot miss. There never was a better bargain driven. My heart in me keeps me and him in one. My heart in him his thoughts and senses guides. He loves my heart, for once it was his own. I cherish his, because in me it bides. My true love hath my heart, and I have his. And the last love poem is by Edward Thomas, which I find haunting. Will you come? Will you come? Will you ride so late at my side? Oh, will you come? Will you come? Will you come if the night has a moon full and bright? Oh, will you come? Would you come? Would you come if the noon gave light, not the moon? Beautiful, would you come? Would you have come? Would you have come without scorning had it been still morning? Beloved, would you have come? If you come, haste and come. Owls have cried, it grows dark to ride. Beloved, beautiful, come. I remember Robert Frost remarking once, one evening, sitting in his log cabin up in Vermont, how certain lines of great poetry can cling like burrs caught on a country walk. And one example he quoted for me was from a Shakespeare sonnet. He that has power to hurt and will do none. That, said Frost, had meant much to him in his life. And for myself, there's one phrase which has followed me all my life like a lodestar. Keep innocency, I thee command. Innocence, of course, is not the same as ignorance. There's no excuse ever for being ignorant. But innocence is a quality that is quickly lost unless we're watchful. It is that child's sense of wonder gazing up at the night sky with which we began earlier in this selection. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, puts it in a way which delights me enormously. Don't climb out on intellectual branches. Stay in the root of your being. And it's for this reason that I've always loved this passage from George Eliot's Adam Bede, where Adam says, I've seen pretty clear, ever since I was a young'un, as religion something else besides doctrines and notions, I begin to see as all this weighing and sifting what this text means and that text means, and whether folks are saved by God's grace or whether there goes an ounce of their own will to it, was no part of real religion at all. You may talk of these things for hours and end, you'll only be the more coxy and conceited for it. And I found it better for my soul to be humble before the mysteries of God's dealings and not to be making a clatter about what I could never understand. And similarly, I love the remark of the schoolmaster in Hardy's Jude the Obscure. I don't know, I don't know. As I say, I'm only a feeler, not a reasoner, which reminds me of what a small boy once said to me. God is a feel, not a think. People sometimes say to me, I'm old. And I say, no, you are older. To say I'm old with this final D is like a door slamming. Whereas the word older suggests a continuing journey of discovery. As Yeats puts it in a poem, there's just one verse. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing and louder sing for every tatter in his mortal dress. Nor is there singing school but studying monuments of his own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. As we journey, age creeps up on us, but a sense of humour is the greatest of all gifts. And so I come once again to Lewis Carroll. You're old, Father William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white. And yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think at your age it is right? In my youth, Father William replied to his son, I feared it might injure the brain. But now that I'm perfectly sure I have none, why do it again and again? You are old, said the youth, as I mentioned before, and have grown most uncommonly fat. Yet you turned a back somersault into the door. Pray, what is the reason of that? In my youth, said the sage, as he shook his grey locks, I kept all my limbs very supple by use of this ointment, 1 shilling the box. Allow me to sell you a couple. You are old, said the youth, and your jaws are too weak for anything stronger than suet. Yet you finished the goose with the bones and the beak. Pray, how did you manage to do it? In my youth, said his father, I took to the law and argued each case with my wife. And the muscular strength it gave to my jaws lasted the rest of my life. You are old, said the youth. One would hardly suppose that your eye was as steady as ever. Yet you balanced an eel on the end of your nose. What made you so awfully clever? I have answered 3 questions, and that is enough, said his father. Don't give yourself airs. Do you think I can listen all day to such stuff? Be off, or I'll kick you downstairs. I've always loved epitaphs, and in my boyhood in the Forest of Dean, coming out of our church, the first gravestone one saw was a perfect example of what I can only describe as grave humour. It said simply, here lies Josiah Trump, who awaits the last trump. And here is another which I think is fabricated. Joanna Jane Jones, who ate plums and then swallowed the stones, now lies in this hollow neath a stone she can't swallow. There are sermons in stones. Perhaps the most haunting of all poems about the journey of life is by the Greek poet Kafafi, which is called Ithaca. When you set out on your journey to Ithaca, then pray that the road is long, full of adventure, full of knowledge. Do not fear the Laestrygonians and the Cyclopes and the angry Poseidon. You will never meet such as these on your path. If your thoughts remain lofty, if a fine emotion touches your body and spirit, then pray that the road is long, that the summer mornings are many, that you will enter port, seen for the first time with such pleasure, such joy. Stop at Phoenician markets and purchase fine merchandise, mother of pearl and corals, amber and ebony, and pleasurable perfumes of all kinds. Buy as many pleasurable perfumes as you can. Visit hosts of Egyptian cities to learn, and learn from those who have knowledge. Always keep Ithaca fixed in your mind. To arrive there is your ultimate goal, but do not hurry the voyage at all. Is it better to let it last long years, and even to anchor the isle when you are old, rich with all that you have gained on the way, not expecting that Ithaca will offer you riches? Ithaca has given you the beautiful voyage. Without her, you would never have taken the road, but she has nothing more to give you. And If you find her poor, Ithaca has not defrauded you. With the great wisdom you have gained, with so much experience, you must surely have understood by then what Ithaca means. I'm going to end with a short poem by Hilaire Belloc, which is a kind of benediction and salutation at the same time. The moon on the one hand, the dawn on the other. The moon is my sister. The dawn is my brother. The moon on my left and the dawn on my right. My brother, good morning. My sister, good night.
That was The Journey Thus Far, written and remembered by James Roose Evans.